Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Now, today we've got special co-host. He's been here for a bit. He just got a new book come out, and so he's been, you know, really busy. Everyone's just, you know, a New York Times review.
Ooh. Hey, Al.
That's Mr. John Copenhaver.
You got it right. Yay.
Oh, that was hard. Everyone knows I have a problem sometimes, and lately it's been more than ever. So that's good. You've done really well, you know?
Yeah, it's been a crazy, crazy fall, but yeah, it's been good. It's been very good.
Yeah, and you were on with Hank Philippi Ryan or whatever, you know, weren't you doing
something? Oh, yeah, a couple of things. Yeah, there's a First Chapter Fun, which was a great thing that she does. She's really a consummate a community, crime writing community member, and always supporting other crime writers. So she does this great thing where they read the first chapter or so of novels during lunchtime. And that was fun. That was great. It was a really fun way. It's her new kind of event to do. So
yeah,
enjoyed it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to get much better next year the way things are going, but we'll see. Yeah,
who knows? Who knows?
And she's got an incredible amount of energy. I do not know how she does that.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of amazing, actually.
It's like she's got coffee going right into her veins or something. It's crazy. And when she was on the show, she was just, wow, slow down. Calm down. It was making it. Well, anyway, so we're on, this is actually the last recording of the year, so that'll be it. And then they'll be playing reruns until January 10th.
Oh, wow.
I know. I get to vacation in Canada. Oh, that's right. It's extra warm up there anyway. Well, so we've got a great guest to end the year in. Great writer. Let's just get him in here and let's start talking. Mr. David Marlette, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks. Good to talk with you both. And like I said, you saved the best for last, right?
Exactly. It was a build-up. That's
right. The whole year has been leading to this one.
The 200 shows before were all just the warm-up acts. You are okay. Britney Spears. Yep. No.
Oh, you did it again.
Yeah. There you go. See, that's what we need to do. You know, yeah, I'm fascinated with it. I think John is too. I think he's a perfect co-host for this one because you are kind of really good at doing historical fiction, like thrillers, but also you've got a lot of real life in your books as well. Like you're doing this really well, and I find this area really fascinating. What makes you write these types of books? You do a lot of historical fiction, like we're talking.
That's really my primary interest. Although now I have decided to, the one I'm currently writing is, I feel like I'm switching art forms because I'm writing a contemporary fiction that has that's not historical, that's not based on a true story. So it's and I'm writing it entirely from a woman's point of view. So there's a part of me that's saying, am I being suicidal? But in any case, no, but I'm going back to, my next one will be back to historical fiction based on major trials. That's really what interests me, you know, primarily is the human drama and the story between, you know, some things that led to extraordinary trials, but the trial is not the centerpiece at all. It's all the people and the characters and what led to get there. And then you do, of course, have that drama of the trial. If it actually does go to trial, the next one I'm doing is the bombing of the Los Angeles Times and Clarence Darrow's activities in Los Angeles in 1910. And just extraordinary story, but it actually doesn't even end up going to a literal trial. Anyway, I got sidetracked. I just find that human drama quite interesting. And I think it's something that we can, that pulls, me and hopefully the reader, if it's got enough interesting characters. I'm not interested in writing just a collection of, coverage of legal trials at all.
Right.
How I pick them is very, they got to speak to me as far as something to say. And American Red, I think, has a lot to say relative to today as well. But in any case.
But how do you assemble something like this for yourself? Like when you talk about Clarence Darrow, of course, and stuff, like when you go back to the trials, and I know in Your Fortunate Son, you were talking about the big trial and in 18th century Ireland, and it really led to some important things. But I find, like, when I went through, I just did like a Leopold and Loeb book and dealt with Clarence Darrow. When you go through a lot of his stuff, it's very at the time, and not a lot of personality. There is, but there isn't. You know what I mean? It's how he's presented himself. And even
it is. He kind of hides himself behind a lot of that. And so I don't try to invent personality that we don't know. In other words, he was rather dry from all appearances, even in his dealings with people. I mean, he personally was enjoyed holding court and being a storyteller at various events when he was invited, that sort of thing. But otherwise, you know, he's pretty quiet about his own life, and there's not a lot out there relative to his. And I'm not trying to write a biography about him at all. He's just one of a catalog of characters. I find him interesting, but a lot of what we do know about him is through his actions and what he did. And I love him because at least in some of us of a certain generation know who he is. I find most of my readers don't know who he is. But certainly the lawyers do, generally, that are, if they're familiar. And the fact that he's, I like it that he's this conciliary for this murderous son of a bitch and deals with a lot of conflicted characters and who he represents. To me, that's a delicious thing where there's no, he's not some, all American, let's all, he's out for money for himself. And when you get into 1910, he's bribing jurors and gets himself thrown out of California. Yeah. He's an interesting conflicted character, but he's not my, in American Red, he's one of some interesting characters that I discovered.
I think what I'm trying to get is how do you make this character come to life when you haven't got a lot of personal details? You know, when they're passed and they're dead, and you kind of have to go through news articles and newspapers, and you have to go through court documents and stuff like that. And I guess that's where the fiction part comes in a sense.
Yeah, I'm not one for nonfiction. I mean, I love reading it. I mean, nonfiction, I read a lot of nonfiction. And I appreciate the art form. It's just not I enjoy the drama, and I want to be able to bring them, you know, give them words and speak and not try to claim that these are things they actually said. Of course, you've got the trial transcripts, which are always a wonderful place to start. Right. And you get a sense for that. And then you have to go into your imagination, obviously, as to what might drive the story. For me, it's because I'm not trying to do a biography. It's all driving the story. Mm-hmm. Is there a theme here? You know, I spent a lot more time in American Red. I spent a fair amount of time, three or four more chapters didn't make it in the book. Of Clarence Darrow, for example, for Clarence Darrow in Chicago with his wife and her relationship with a woman, things that we know were true. What was his relationship? What was experience there? Well, that didn't really drive the story. So a lot of that came out. It was interesting, maybe, might be an interesting biographical sort of thing, but I'm really, even that, I'm not trying to be biographical. I'm just trying to push the narrative. And so to the part that I do deal with he and his wife in a quick scene near the end of the book, you know, it's one, I would take it. My editor was, you know, thinking, is this really, even this part, is it really necessary to this overall story? And I thought, yeah, let's leave it. You know, it's quick. We don't spend a lot of time on it. And it gives a little more character as to him and how she worked with him and some of the things he did. It has to drive the story, I guess is all I'm trying to say. It has to drive the story. You can, especially when you get a cast of characters, which are really interesting. I've got, you know, good grief, so many in this 1910 one that it's really more picking who do I want to bring alive? How is that going to serve the story? Because you can get off and, you know, so many.
So when you're putting together something like this, even American Red, are you sort of looking at trying to, I don't know, how do you say, have a subtext? Are you trying to actually put out some sort of meaning?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's really kind of the only thing that drives me is, not the only thing that drives me, but I'm, what's the takeaway? You know, what's being said here? And that's why I try to do an introduction. You know, I try to use try to set the stage. And I think that there's a lot, we're dealing with this a lot today, this idea of what is socialism? What is, you know, what is corporate power? What is individual rights? What is, you know, we're seeing labor. We're dealing with these same sort of things that where they were certainly dealing with in American Red. It's just that you have this collision of, you know, the Wild West, new technology and the human drama. Well, we've kind of got that today with social media and internet, et cetera, and how it impacts a lot of these things. So to me, there's a lot of crossover, and when I was doing the book tour, that, you know, someone saying that I kind of asked some people, can you tell which side I'm on? And most people, at least the ones I've asked or brought it up, say they can't, which makes me happy.
Yeah.
That both have both sides of these big arguments. Well, in any case, so yeah, I'm definitely trying to, I'm only really interested in stories that I feel like I can see an objective of point A to point B. I'm hoping to move the reader to not just entertain them, but hopefully give them something to mull about. And that's what was so beautiful for me about Fortunate Son. It's not just this trial of amazing trial, but at the end, to me, you know, if it's for the reader to say, but I certainly would hope that there, you know, there's a big question of what's it all worth? Who are we in the end? Are we what society tells us we are, or are we who we make ourselves to be? Which is what, you know, and that's a true story of what James Anglesey chose to do at the end.
If you have to be a little bit more particular, or if you think about when you're putting together a story like either one of these books, in today's kind of climate of political correctness, let's just say, or, you know, awareness, does it sort of make you kind of reanalyze and maybe perhaps write something in a a way that you wouldn't normally?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the short answer is no. I have a little bit of a chip on my shoulder against a lot of that. I think that, especially historical reinvention, I think what's interesting is who we are as just human beings. Every era has its foibles. Every era has its, oh my God, you said that. And it's that just, you know, the next generation is going to be saying that about this one in certain ways. And to me, it's disingenuous and dishonest if you're not taking us back to where they were. And regardless, let the chips fall where they may. It's something that kind of is a little pet peeve of mine, a lot of this historical reinvention in order to soothe the nerves of the modern audience.
Right. I mean, I think sometimes it can be irresponsible because it's misconstruing something about the past, yeah. Right? You know?
Yeah. Humans are humans, and that's the beauty of it. That's what makes the historical fiction to me work is when someone says, yeah, these people are just like us. We're not different. We're not different human beings. We're all capable of some of these horrific things. As a society, we're certainly capable. And we're all capable of some of the extraordinary good. And so that to me is far more interesting. And yeah, no, I don't, there's a key. I'm not giving anything really away in American Red that I discovered about his wife and how she gave her sister to him as his concubine to our main, bad dude. Well, they tried to run that as, I discovered all that through the trial transcripts because they tried to run that in and disparage him at his murder trial, saying what a horrible person he was because he was sleeping with his wife's sister. Well, to me, that's far more interesting. Mm-hmm. I hope people judge because, listen, guess what? They were judging back then too. But let's dig to how interesting. What does that really say about the wife? And she's invalid, and I like to dive into those controversies and make people a little uncomfortable. The very first scene we see of her is she's listening to them having sex through the wall and she's wishing they'd hurry up and finish so they can get to dinner and hoping her husband's going to be in a better mood. I love the conflict and she's deeply religious and she's got a murderer for a husband and who also does a lot of good. He's one of the people that caused the beginning of anti-child labor laws and healthcare and wages, fair wages and 8-hour work days and all those kinds of things. At the same time, he was a tremendous murdering son of a bitch. What a wonderful.
Well, yeah, it's like human complexity, right? I mean,
and he's sleeping with his wife's sister and I know most of my readers are female. And so I enjoy poking a little bit and saying, yeah, be careful before you start judging her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is she not, maybe she's just trying to live her life. She's, as best she knows how. So that's the fun I kind of have relative. That's a long-winded answer, but to today's foibles, I'm more interested in showing how this isn't anything new. Us, our social struggle with right and wrong, and what offends and what doesn't offend, and character assassinations or over heroizing certain people. That's nothing new.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. One thing that is different about what you're doing versus what I'm doing is I don't actually write about, I put things in real, of course, historical periods, but I don't write about historical, events. I mean, I don't really try to fictionalize historical events. They're kind of happening in the background and impact characters, but you actually take, historical characters and you imbue them with fictional life, and I'm always curious about that because at what point do you feel like, you have done enough research, you feel like confident enough to like dive into and start filling in the gaps fictionally? I never know quite myself, so that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, as you're saying too, I think you'd agree that there is no right way or a way or anything else. I truly let the story lead me. I know this particular thing happened. I know they got my main guy. They abducted him in this, you know, zero dark 30 way and threw got him on a train. Well, I knew the basics. Well, what conversations might have had to have happened in order to get to that point? And so that's, you know, some of those where I'm just totally making it up. I have no, you know, there's no record of who talked to who. I just know you've got a practical action that has to happen. So what's the more interesting conversation behind the scenes? What are the whispers in the dark waiting, trying to pounce on this guy? What's he doing at that time? I don't know. I just know where they arrested him. I know they arrested him in bed with his wife's sister. Okay, well, by that point in the story, I don't want that to be a shock to the reader, although it was a shock to those people at the time. So that informs me a little bit. You know, how would this big guy, giant guy that's, you know, fierce, how would he react when someone's busting down his door? You know, those kinds of things, I don't know. I don't know what happened. There's no record of that. But I feel like I can be as true, to answer your question, is I definitely feel a responsibility to be as true as I possibly can to what we do know. Mm-hmm. And then don't get too carried away, you know. You know, try to stay within round, you know, just, again, humans are humans. What would happen today? Well, it's probably the same thing that happened then. I mean, as far as basics are concerned. But I do try to find, you know, I needed to move the story forward with, for example, a scene between the wife and her sister. Well, imagining what their relationship was. You know, they love each other. The wife wants the sister to be around. The wife is in a wheelchair, you know, with polio, and she's, and so I needed a conversation somewhere. The story was needing a conversation between these two women as to their relationship with the same man. You have to imagine that surely they had the conversation plenty of times, right? Of course. So therefore I'm giving this as a long-winded sort of example. I start searching for a scene. Where can I put these women to have a reasonable conversation where the reader's also getting something interesting to see? I just don't want to sit them back in the parlor sitting there across from each other in two chairs. And so I just, you know, I start going in doing the research of what's happening in Denver at that time. What's new? What's going on? Where would these women maybe want to go? Holy cow, I discovered that the first gigantic department store was opening that year. Did it open on the exact same month I needed it to open? No. Okay, I'm fine with moving what month. So let's let these two women go and walk through a department store and talk as they walk. And that to me was just sort of the fun of historical fiction. Mm-hmm. The saying, okay, I get to now. So I spent, you know, way too long researching every detail I could about, okay, what floor would they be on? What would they see? What was there? You know, and trying to take that reader into that view of, at the same time, I get the story points moved forward and we get to see them in action. Because the sister's got a bigger budget from the husband than the wife does. What conflict would that be? So anyway, point is, I'm sorry. I got off of your question, I think.
No.
It's a discovery. It's the story's got to drive it. And then trying to find those interesting moments, where you can say, why not just put them there? And when I discovered the killer, one of our awful, awful killer that went to San Francisco and poisoned a family, you know, I was like, okay, we're going to write that scene. That's a dark, dark scene. Yeah, okay, I want to write it. And then I started thinking, wait a minute, this is San Francisco 6 months after the Great Fire and Earthquake. Well, what would that look like? That's a thing we've never seen before. What was disaster recovery? And we're in the middle of dealing with that a fair amount in the news. Well, what was disaster recovery look like then? And then lo and behold, I discovered that this old man named Holt had, right at that same time, had the very first time he ever brought his invention called a caterpillar off of the farms in California to try to be used for industrial use was in the cleanup of the San Francisco fire. So I thought, what an interesting scene to have a bunch of men, as we all men do, sit around and watch somebody else work on a machine. And so, you know, I thought, okay, I know Holt Caterpillar was there. I know it was the first time it was ever used. All right. So I guarantee you that thing didn't work 100% of the time. And if it's not working and old man Holt's out there working on it, what an interesting scene to have this psychopathic murderer. For a moment, he becomes like any other man, and he's just standing there amongst the other men, watching them try to fix the thing. I thought that was just an interesting moment to be able to play, and for those people who were kind of thinking, oh, Holt Caterpillar, wow, that's the, it's a little piece of history that's accurate. That's the fun, I guess. I can get off on this too much, but this is the fun. I really have fun with that kind of thing. What can I do that's accurate that adds texture, mm-hmm. that doesn't take away from the story, and we don't have to linger too long on it, but can bring us forward?
I've always found that readers, of course, they're reading first and foremost for the story, but I always get little details like that. They usually get very strong response. I'm always sort of amazed that they do, but they really do.
Yeah, I think it's all painting. I did spend a fair amount of time working screenplays in the film world, and I think it is, it's our obligation to paint, and that's who our reader is today. I mean, they're watching series on Netflix. And I think it's such a visual medium, the writing. Mm-hmm. It needs to be a visual, in my opinion, it needs to be a visual medium. The readers need an opportunity to plug into their brain and paint pictures. So paint some pictures.
Yeah. And it makes all the difference, because if you could create the setting, the atmosphere, because so much of that is missing, and there's no way someone today in 2021 is going to understand what it was like to be in 1921, for instance, in a city, because there's all the different things going on around the people, who was famous, what stores were open, what there's all of those, like you were talking about. You need all of that to create the platform for them to really understand why people act and react the way they do.
Well, to me, that's the fun, is the sensory part, too. It's, Unfortunate Son, just thinking, what would it sound like to be on the streets of Dublin in 1715? How quiet would it be? Mm-hmm. We don't realize how quiet it is. So there's a big element of that about the church bells. Well, you can hear those damn things from a long ways away. There's not much else going on. You know, it's clip-clops of hooves and men talking and people talking. That's about it. And there's something about that, to me, that's that same thing. It's that immersivity. I think we kind of that's what I find fun in historical fiction, is that hopefully, this is for the reader to decide, but that's my ambition anyway. Is to immerse them a bit in that choice of picking and choosing what sensory elements are going to help them feel immersed.
It's like it's essentially kind of world building, mm-hmm. the way that, you think of it in terms of sci-fi or fantasy, but we're, world building the past.
Yeah. And it's all a choice. Those choices are fun, John. I know as you know, I find them fun to be. I can get stuck trying to figure out, well, what can I do? Yeah. I've got the scene and I don't really have anything to. And then you feel like you're overdoing it. I do sometimes. I don't know if you do, but where you feel like, okay, I got too many interesting scenes in a row. How about some, I need to burn a few boring moments. Does everything have to be done in some interesting thing? No. Let's burn a few boring moments too in just the passivity of ordinary life.
Do you ever create characters out of the blue just to fill or make something move along?
Oh yeah. Very much. Especially in American Red, the main two young characters are fictional. And they're amalgams. There are true people. There was undercover agents for the Pinkertons and given a code name. I just didn't know their actual name, his actual name. One of the far cousins of Al Capone was.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There, she was there. The Capone family. I knew that there was a young spy they sent in to try to mix up the prosecution. So I thought, okay, let's make her one and the same person. Let's make Capone's cousin be this spy. Okay. I know that's true that these two people were there. I'm okay with that. And so now I'm going to move them forward. I'm going to use them because my reader sort of reacted well to them. I'm going to bring those two forward into 1910 in my next, American White, which is going to be the next novel after American Red, but to tell this story in Los Angeles. I find that sort of useful. And I get kind of build them with everybody else being accurate, as much as possible.
Where do they come from? Like, how do you create characters like that? Is it completely in your mind, or are you finding people out there that you've met or take it from them, or kind of everything?
I guess I'm really doing that now with this, the Art of Being Betsy, which is what I'm writing right now, which is entirely fictional characters. And they're all amalgams of real people. They're all people I know put together. In American Red, it started with what I knew was true, what actually happened, I didn't really have names, but had two or three. It more was a pragmatic thing, and then I started. So I kind of built stick figures that needed to be certain places and were certain places. Maybe there's two or three of them, but I decided to make them one. And then you start fleshing them out, I think. That's how I did it for that, because I had sort of stick figures in certain places, and I started, and then it was also, I have my main, very true character, the main Pinkerton detective. I wanted to soften, see him being more paternal and being softer. He was known as a hard ass, and I want my readers to see him a little more three-dimensionally. So that's when I started thinking, okay, let's let that guy be, brought under his wing. And that gives them a conversation, a place to move story, gives them somebody to talk to. And we understand that we can learn a lot about how dangerous that all is by watching him be concerned about this young man. I got off of my story. I'm just making, I'm pulling them out of people I know. I think. But like I say, when it's historical fiction, there's a framework underneath.
Right.
Whereas like the current fiction I'm writing now is, there's no framework underneath, which is a little, a little, it's just different. It's different.
I was going to say that because I've written true crime or nonfiction all along. So a lot of your characters in my case, they're sort of already predetermined. You find out about them. I can't make them a certain thing. They are who they are. They did what they did. Right. And that's kind of how you probably have structured your first ones. But when you get into the newer one that you got next year for The Art of Being Betsy, you don't have any of that guideline. So it's completely in your own. Did you like that kind of writing? Has it been good?
Yes and no. I feel like I'm I don't know, maybe this isn't a good example, but a sculptor who's decided to go over and try to throw a clay pot. It's just a different, I'm looking forward to getting back to historical fiction. But I like what I have something I'm trying to say. I'm more worried I'm being too on the nose. I'm trying to be a little more, there's something that I wanted to say in this book. I mean, I like it and it's fine. I'm looking forward to getting back to historical fiction. I'm glad to have done it. It's an interesting challenge, a personal challenge. And I think I'm proud of the book. I think it's going to be a good thing.
It feels more direct.
I love the research. I love finding those little pieces and saying, can I move this in here? What did they think when they heard a telephone ringing? And some people had telephones and some didn't in 1906 and 07. And some of them didn't trust them at all. They'd much rather be on telegraph,
Yeah.
What about cars? What do men think? Seeing, we think about, especially I love diving into these guys. They're already starting this idea of, lusting over and talking about different kind of automobiles. Well, that's brand new conversation. Who's ever had that conversation before? I have a scene where it's one of those little personal things. I don't know, John, if you have these, where you kind of write them in. You get a kick out of it. You don't know if your readers even gonna notice it. But you're like, it made me smile, so I put it in there. But, and I just have this scene where these two guys are leaning against a car and realizing we can't lean against a horse. This is the very first time we take it for totally granted that two guys will sit out and lean on a car and have a conversation. Well, they might have leaned against a wagon, but it was just sort of they just had this moment of notice, like, oh, we're just out here leaning, Well, that's a stupid little thing, but I find it sort of funny. I got way off your point. I don't even remember.
It's much cooler to lean against a car than a wagon, I'll say.
Yeah, there's something about that. I don't know, but did readers notice that? I kind of almost hope they don't, because that means that I've made it so subtle. Otherwise, it's just one of those little writer's kicks you get. I don't know, John, do you have that same sort of, when you're writing historical, the final little moments?
Yeah, I definitely will slip in some things that are kind of just for me. Absolutely. Like references to things that you would not, maybe like someone might get, but I'm just acknowledging it's for me,
Right.
And if someone happens upon it or, that's great, but it's there. Easter eggs, I guess.
Yeah. My biggest problem with Unfortunate Son was the extraordinary coincidences that happened in the historical record. I mean, I've got the original newspaper articles that his friend would run into his friend after he's been sold into slavery. He's been for 14 years. He's going to run into his friend, his Irish friend that he hasn't seen for 14 years, just on the docks in Yorktown. What the hell? I really wanted to write a note in the margin, before people throw the book across the room going, no, this is
bull. Oh my.
To say, no, actually, this actually happened. But that's
I was going to ask about that, because we talked sort of about inventing characters, but I'm sure, although you're dealing with historical events, there's still, you know, so you can still play around with structure and,
yeah,
and how you might approach something like that. You know, I mean, what can you do? I mean, it's a coincidence. It's important, you know, important to the storytelling, and you can't really but do you massage it a little bit?
I gave the characters a, you've got to be kidding me conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I let them be as astonished.
Right.
As hopefully
right.
the reader would be. So it doesn't look like I'm just going, oh yeah, and they happen to run into each other, and here we go. Like, it, that's what, you know, that's all I can do is just let you feel how astonished they are. Because you're thinking it did happen, so they must have been really astonished. And so I think that was worthy of taking a few beats and letting, you know, that was all I could do really. But yes, I definitely wanted to write something in the margin. You know.
And it's like a good writing tip. Like if you need to move something like that readers might raise eyebrows at, have the characters acknowledge it.
Right. Oh yeah.
And then the reader will feel better about it.
Yeah. If they, and I, you know, I put an excerpt of the actual newspaper in the book, in the opening of that chapter, like I'm hoping, no, this is actually, but they don't really know if I made that up or not. You know, that newspaper.
Sure. Yeah.
So when I did book tours for that, I carried that newspaper with me. And showed that. I was like, I actually have these original newspapers from 1700s. That's it's fun. It's fun. It's fun to do. And you can, you know, get yourself a little, but it's like the Leopold Mode thing. I wouldn't write that one.
Because, yeah. And looking back at it,
because it doesn't have enough, you know, it doesn't have enough. You ask a question about, you know, am I trying to say something in these or whatever? I don't think it has enough to say. I thought about it because it kind of takes place between, you know, these two books, not American Red and what's going to be American White and then eventually American Blue. But it takes place in the time period. And I just like, you know what? You know, there's just not enough. I don't think it has enough to say, you know.
Yeah. And for me, I was trying to capture it just them two and their relationship, but I'm trying to put it in a bigger series of a couple of books.
Oh, you're writing this. I didn't mean that. Oh, I thought you said you read something on
them. Yeah, no, I wrote that as part of a series.
That sounded terrible, me saying.
I agree totally.
That way.
It's not something I would attack in that way because of saying something, except for the idea that because they were gay that they were killers. My thought was that they had a relationship. There was a unique part of their relationship, but we have a lot of killer couples out there,
right?
And I'm trying to take away the stereotype of two gay men that were
right
obviously something bad in that time period and illegal and probably thought of as quite ill in certain ways. I'm trying to separate that.
Well, the interesting thing for me is that, yeah, mass murders can be gay. Guess what?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, or they weren't mass murders, but murders can be, I mean, the human, and in fact, that's all the more humanizing, regardless of sexual proclivity.
Exactly.
There's good and bad.
Right.
And that's kind of the
damn
point.
Difference, you know?
And that was kind of the point. The same as Fritz Haarman, like some of these killers that I'm bringing out, I'm trying to make them look as, I don't want to say this normal, but normal as normal right. people are. Like they're not doing this because of their sexual, what they like. They're right. doing it because of something else. And so I think that was kind of my point in that thing. But may not be accepted as well as I thought it would be, but doesn't right. matter. You know,
well, I think that's just it. Well, any point, it's not so much that you can write about anything. You just got to know what sort of perspective or point of view you want to take with it. And I mean, certainly, you know, I think historically there's been a lot of conflation with criminality and homosexuality, and you're trying to separate those two, right? Essentially,
yeah.
So they're not necessarily related. The problem here has nothing to do with homosexuality. The problem here has to do with a whole other relationship dynamic that is
exactly.
problematic.
See, yeah. I, you can write my forward.
You know what? I did.
Yeah. Anyway, that's another story. We're here for David here. Now, I have to ask this question because we get a lot of fictional writers, and it seems very unusual to me. But when I ask fictional writers what their relationship is with the characters, quite a few of them tell me it's like their family, it's like their friends or children. I hear all these words, and they hear their voices in their heads and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
And I think it's really bizarre, because I've always stuck to nonfiction, and sort of like you, even historical fiction, I'm kind of doing things in that area, so I don't quite get it. But maybe you have an opinion on this. Like, what are your made up characters to you? Like, how do you see them?
If I don't have an emotional relationship with them, I think that's a recipe for not particularly good writing. In my feelings, I better have an emotional relationship with them if I want to bring them alive. To me, that's a fast path for a cardboard character if you're not feeling some connection. For me, I don't mean to talk about any other writer. I'm just saying for me, I'm not artificially creating that, but if I'm finding myself, you know, not that invested, well, ooh, that's a bad sign. I feel more connected though. I mean, boy, when I found James Annesley's grave, I just wept. I mean, he's a real character. No one's ever told his story. And I just got so invested in this real person who made these true. I mean, there's scenes in there that just, you know, that I discovered, you know, his relationship with, and there's a lot of personal, you know, that you bring in that we just don't know a lot of those things. So I get very personally connected with him and his friend. But in American Red, my personal connection is more with the fictional one. I do. I care. I have to care. I think you have to care. I don't know how you could do it. I think that's going to come through. I think it's, you know, like a musician playing a piece of music. If you're not emotionally invested, we're going to hear that. I think there needs to be some emotional investment. I've teared up plenty of times writing, and I don't tell people that. I mean, I'm telling people that now, but I mean, it's not artificial. I kind of roll with it, you know?
Yeah. Do you hear voices in your head too? Or
no, I hear conversations a lot. I mean, cause I let my mind roll with, okay, I try to go in that room and turn them loose and just listen to them. Talking, oftentimes it's just, I can't make out the words. And I just get closer to them, and then I start, you know, that sounds a little hokey, but it's just kind of my method. You know, obviously I'm the one creating that. I don't believe in all this, you know, I let my characters write, whatever. I do, that's my exercise of the art, is to go in and just try to sit in that room and just listen, try to listen to them, try to, as best I can, to hear what they might be, you know, how might that conversation go down, or what might they be feeling. It just depends on the character and where I am in the story, and
Well, you're a very, at this point too in your life, you're very accomplished. You've done, you know, lots of good work here, and you've got kind of a status, and you appear quite confident. How does that come to a writer? Like you, like that wasn't that way from the beginning.
No.
What is that one pivotal thing, or is there something that, an event or something that goes on that all of a sudden makes you feel confident, like you're doing something that's good?
You know, it's, I'd love to say it's somehow internal, but it's not. Let's be honest. It's that affirmation. We're doing this for, I mean, yes, I write because, you know, I'd write if no one was going to read it. But let's be honest, I'm writing because I want to connect, you know, with others. So when you get that confirmation, and I do this in writing workshops when I work with writers, but it's finding that connection when you get that spark of connection, there's nothing like it. It's just like I've done some things on stage earlier in my life a lot. And, you know, it's that audience reaction. It's that, hey, it's not, oh, look at me. It's, wow, there's a connection there. You know, that's it. That's the good stuff. That's that you're chasing that high. You know, I want to make that connection. And once I knew I could make that connection, when Fortunate Son started pulling in the reviews it certainly changed. I'm no longer sweating agents and publishers and all that. And there is a freedom of, no, people, this is going to get published and this will be tapped into people's heads. You know, to me, it's like a wire stuck in their brain, you know, and you're getting to play pictures in there. So do it right, damn it, because they're going to do it. You have that opportunity. I think there's a confidence that builds there once you know, you know, talking to other writers who aren't published yet, there's still that confidence. Is anybody going to ever read this? And is it going to be any good? And once you get the sense of, no, people will read this, and I have the capacity for it to be good. Notice I said I have the capacity. I'm not trying to say everything at all is good. I'm just saying once you acknowledge that you do have the capacity to create good work, then I think that's where the confidence comes, in my opinion.
Do you like the current, let's say, atmosphere of social media, where a lot of people can connect with you all the time and constantly? Because not everyone is going to be nice, especially of, you know, the way it is, and, you know, nowadays.
Right.
Is that sort of a good thing, or is it added stress, or do you sort of worry about what you can or can't
do? Many other things in my life, in politics, and I've gotten myself into so many other things that interest me, and outside of writing, I don't really care. I don't really draw any negative. I mean, I'd like to get that, you know, if I'm drawing negative, it means that means I'm even more successful. We all just know we're writing in a, it's more the whole thing. It's not really your question, but my whole point about the whole social media and the online is just nobody's reading anymore. And that's the overall frustration, is just the great loss of, you know, our art form has to change, and trying to write to the modern reader. That's more the challenge. You know, that's where I feel, maybe you gentlemen would do too. I feel like I'm in the wrong, you know, wrong generation.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's interesting,
but it's a challenge. I mean, that we all have to be up for the challenge.
Do you like the whole Amazon thing? Self-publishing and people just and scattering, that there's tons of things out there. Because I have mixed feelings, because I see the ability of someone not needing a publisher, and I think that's great, but it's also bad because there's a lot of people that don't.
Yeah.
You know, there's something. Yeah, there's something you get out of a publisher, you know, the editing, the process, and being good enough, you know, and making yourself better.
Wait a minute, your publisher actually edits?
You know
what I mean. I think that you can, just like anything else, you can overflood the market, and it doesn't increase it's like people complaining about, oh, all these musicians, you know, only a few get attention. Well, yeah, because it's flooded. Anybody can go shove their stuff out there on, and that may feel good to them, but that doesn't, I think it only herds the audience more into just the big names because of the noise. I mean, you get so much noise, you just start looking for only, I think it doesn't invite readers to go explore as much, because they know once you walk into that exploration room, there's a million things. As opposed to, you can be in the nice, safe, curated room. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Before, the other room of exploration may be, you know, several hundred, but it was more of an open exploration as opposed to just a wall of noise. which maybe I'm not, this is just a theory. I mean, I don't know if this is true. This is just the way I feel about it a bit.
Yeah. Well, that's true. But just does the noise affect you? And not only the noise from that, but just the whole world. I mean, in cases of, you know, like the pandemic and you've got, you know, political things going on, you have this, it seems like there's a wild world. And does that stress you in your writing? Are you the type that gets affected by it?
No, I think maybe that's what it is. But us historical fiction guys or historical people, it's just, there's nothing new.
Yeah.
You know,
it isn't.
Yeah. Is it new? You know, this isn't, I mean, I find it interesting that it's not new. I'm not saying it's boring that it's not new, but I find it actually interesting that it's not new. So it's more of a, you know, I'm already thinking, I mean, I stay away from it. I thought of, in this fiction I'm working right now, you know, I thought about letting one of my protagonists, you know, love interest die of COVID. And I thought, no, no, nobody wants to read that. So that's kind of the influence I kind of get. It's just kind of like, well, all right, but otherwise, this too shall pass and it'll be something else. And, you know,
yeah,
I think that the human drama at the core, the people watching other people struggle with the, you know, the existential issues of their day. I think there's power in that and seeing how they overcame. People had to overcome so much more than we're having to overcome. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, that, yeah, it's a long-winded answer, but no, it doesn't really bother me too much. Just, you know, at all. I mean, it doesn't impact me as far as my writing is concerned. No, I'm just kind of like, maybe people will read more. I don't know if that's true though.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the audiobook element is a good thing. I mean, I'm excited about that. I'm about to record American Red, myself, my publishers, we've kind of decided that I'm going to do it myself. You know, I'm looking forward to that. I think there's you're doing this podcast. I think there's some other opportunities for telling stories. I think, I'm getting off. Yeah. I'll hush and let you answer
that. I love the audiobook thing because as my eyes get worse and I'm getting older, I love listening to a lot of the books. And and it's good to do it to yourself because when it comes from you, the writer, you don't have to fake the feeling throughout it. It's real. It's coming from you.
I think you're still certainly is very much of an art form. You know, a lot of writers have no business reading their own because they, you know, they don't understand acting enough or the subtlety of how to do that line. You know, they just think. So I'm even though I have some experience with it, I'm still a bit nervous about it, especially because I have all these multiple characters. I've been watching all these. You know, I'm getting ready. Like, just how subtly do I want to shift between characters? All those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But Fortunate Son has to have a British, a native British reader do it. I would never do that. My accent would just come through and it would ruin it.
Yeah. Yeah. It wouldn't sound real. Like, if you're doing it that way. Yeah. And you're not going to sound like a woman very much, are you? The sister.
No. And it's an interesting. Well, it's interesting. I was watching some things recently on how to. I just been really concerned about that. Or thinking, concern, you know, just thinking, trying to teach myself about how to use the vocal instrument in a way that doesn't sound like you're a man trying to talk like a woman, you know, not in that.
Oh, my.
But you're trying to be, you know, but how do they do that? And so, you know, there's things like that. I'm trying to teach myself a little bit about, you know, using the instrument. It's a different form of art, but it's still our story. And it's, and again, it's all about connecting with that audience. So,
Well. David, we're running out of time, so let's talk about contact. So where do you like people to find you? Is it your website, or do you like social media?
Yeah, I think that's the easiest way. Just my davidmarlett.com. There's a contact there. That's usually the easiest way. More direct. I'm also on Facebook, but whatever.
Well, fantastic. Well, we got your two books up, and we'll have that, your website as well. And, of course, be on the lookout for the book next year, early of 2022.
I think it's going to be later. Yeah, it'll be later, 2022.
Yeah. Yeah, you've been out partying too much, right?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, right. Exactly. It's my teaching load, man. I'm a professor at law school, and law school's in a
I don't know how you do it.
It's got me a little side behind. I'm behind schedule. How about that? I think we all three would understand that.
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of a
I'm a teacher as well, so I got you.
Behind constant. Schedule. Yeah.
Never ends.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate it. Our guest today, of course, is Mr. David Marlette. Thank you for being here.
Well, I really appreciate you guys inviting me, and it's just been, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
Get the latest news and opinions from Eric Shapiro from the House of Mystery website in the Shapiro Report.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.